Well, good evening or good afternoon to everyone. Without everyone having webcams, it's a limit hakolot. But I hope that I'll recognize all of you as you speak, and you'll feel comfortable to ask questions as we go along. What we're attempting to do is present a method that empowers people to learn on their own. And we're going to do this by learning in certain with the psukim from the Mikra, from the Torah, that are relevant to the topic of Perek HaMafkid. And after the psukim, we're going to look at the Mishnah. And after the Mishnah, we're going to look at the parallel literature of the Tanaim, Tosefta, and Braitot. Following that, we'll go into the sugya that we're going to study today, and we're going to separate the sugya into its layers, Amoraic layers and Stama Digmara, and see what each layer fashioned at hand. Another point that is very important at this stage of learning is to learn every source kipshuto. There are many levels at which every source can be studied, but we're going to try to learn things on a level of pshat, so that those of us who are learning for the first time, or those of us that are beginners in this method, will be able to hone their skills before we delve too deeply into Rishonim and Achronim. So those are materials that were sent out for this lecture. You received three documents. The Sukkim from the Mikra, from Shmot. And then you also received the Mishnah and the Makbilot. And third, you received the Sugyot in Perek HaMafkid, set up according to Shitat HaRivadim. So let's, if everyone could please take out their document of Shmot Perek Chavbet, and let's take a look at the psukim that are the background for our perek, and let's understand the basic issues that arise from looking at the pshat of the psukim. So if you see that in Shmot Perek Chavbet, psukim vav to yud dalid, we have a number of us. Ki yiten ish el re'ehu kesef o kelim lishmor v'gunav mibeit ha'ish im yimatzei aganav yishalek im lo yimatzei aganav v'nikrav bal habayit el ha'elohim im lo shalach yado bin lechet re'ehu. So these psukim are discussing the giving of a trust of a fidelity to the hand of someone, and it's stolen from the guardian. And if the thief is found, then the thief will pay double theft. If he's not found, then the balabait, the owner of the object, will go to the court together with the guardian, and the guardian will have his hand on his neighbor's. And this is the main theme that runs straight through this section, that is that the guardian has an obligation to either guard the one is entrusted to him with effectiveness, or he's going to have to take an oath that he was not involved in what happened to it. And then ish el re'ehu chamor o shor o se v'chol behema lishmor umet o nishbar o nishba ein ro'eh. And this is talking about the entrusting of an animal, different kinds of animals, and it dies, or it is broken in the field, it's damaged in the field, or it's taken away, and no one sees it, no one knows what happened. Shivuat Hashem tiyeh bein shnehem im lo shalach yado bimelechet re'ehu. Again, there will be an oath taken before God between the owner of the animal and the guardian, whether or not this guardian put his hand on his neighbor's property. And you see that idea repeats itself from Pasuk Zayin. And then in Pasuk Yod Aleph, im ganov yiganev mi'imo, if it is stolen from him, if the animal is stolen from the guardian, yishalem liva alav, he will pay the owner. And this is very strange, because we saw in Pasuk Vav that it says, v'gunav mi'beit ha'ish, if it's stolen from the house of the guardian, then he's exempt. So what is happening here between these various psukim? Would anyone like to say another of these psukim? The silence is resounding. Who would like to suggest a pshat? Well, I don't hear anyone. The first three psukim, Vav, Zayin, and Chet, are dealing with one kind of guardian, whereas Tet, Yud, Yud Aleph, and Yud Bet are dealing with another kind of shomer. As Jay just wrote in his email, different shomrim. And so we have at the beginning a lesser level of obligation, and if something is stolen from him, he has in Pasuk Tet, Yud, Yud Aleph, and Yud Bet, we have a guardian with a higher level of obligation, and for that, if something is stolen from him, that's not enough for him to take an oath. He has to pay. But if there's some other accidental damage done to the animal for which he cannot be held responsible, then he may take an oath. So therefore, what we have is two different kinds of shomrim here. And then in Pasuk Yud Gimel, we have another kind of shomer. V'chi yish'al ish me'im re'ehu, v'nishbar omid. This is a third kind of guardian, a borrower. V'alav in imo shalem yishalem. And if anything happens to it, then the owner say, in v'alav imo, but if the owner is there and was supervising the activity, lo yishalem, he doesn't have to pay. What type of guardian? If he's a renter, if he's rented the object or the animal, then the issue related is part of his rental agreement. So in short, the psukim deal with four different kinds of shomrim. And they are listed in ascending order of levels of responsibility. The first level of responsibility, which the Rabbanim referred to as a shomer chinam, one who is doing the guardianship as a favor for his friend. The second shomer being a shomer sachar, a shomer who is being paid for his guardianship, and therefore he has a hachan. We have the shoel, the borrower, and the sachir, the renter, the socher. Now these four levels of guardianship, level in the psukim, over one basic message, and that is we want to avoid a situation where a guardian is putting his hand on his neighbor's property, that a guard honesty and to be and take care of it. But this general principle is very unclear. What does it mean to property? Since if your neighbor entrusts you $50 to watch, and you watch the $50, but while you're watching it, you also use it for investment and put it back immediately afterwards. Is that called putting your hand on your neighbor's property? What if your neighbor entrusted to you a bushel of apples and he came back late to put your hand on the apples to save them? Is that called putting your hand on your neighbor's property illegally? And what happens if your neighbor asks you to watch a barrel of wine? And you mix the wine together with your own wine in order to watch it efficiently. And then when you act in, are shmarim, there are leftovers of the substance of the grape, that means that there's now less a volume of wine. How much do you return to him? And if you don't return the full amount to him, is that putting your hand on your neighbor's property? There are many questions versus themselves. In other words, the Torah Shebichtav gives us a general concept, it gives us, but it doesn't flesh out of how this is to be observed kehalacha. And that is the purpose of the Torah Shebal Peh, that is the purpose of the Mishnah. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a look now at the parak of Mishnah, that is interpreting and filling out the details on these psukim, and we're going to discover some very interesting things about the way this parak was organized and how it relates to the psukim. So if all of you could please take out your second document, the document of Mishnat Masechet Bava Metzia, the Mishnah and the Mekorot Makbilin, the parallel sources. Are there any questions, first of all, about the psukim before we go on to the study of the Mishnah? No questions. Is anyone there?
We're here.
My friends, do you hear
people
me?
Are quiet. I know people, it takes them a class or two to warm up to the use of technology. So in the meantime, they can always like chat with any questions. But I'll go ahead with the Mishnah, and, we'll see. So type in the questions.
Okay. So I assume you had to look at the Mishnah in today's meeting, and you noted, as I'm sure, when you looked through the Perek, you found that there are 12 Mishnayot in the Perek. And these 12 Mishnayot deal with a certain series of topics that are connected to the matter at hand. What I'd like us to do is go through these 12 Mishnayot, take a look at how they're organized, what they deal with, and how every topic that they raise is connected to the issue of the guardianship, because the way the Mishnah was put together by Rav Yehuda Nasi, it was a combination of two factors, of two components. The first was the running flow of discussion on the topic, and second were insertions into this flow of topics and units that he brought in from the outside from other compilations of Mishnah. And there was often a rather rugged topography in Mishnah. And we have to go through it and make order so we know what we're dealing with. So let's take a look. The first Mishnah says, Hamafkid etzel chaviro behema ochelim v'nignevu o she'avdu shilem v'lo ratza li shavva shahare amru shomer chinam nishpa v'yotze tzav v'em tashlum eichet tavach u'machar mishalem tashlum e'arba'a v'chamisha. What case is this dealing with? A person entrusts to his friend an animal or utensils to watch, and they're stolen or they're lost. If the guardian decides to pay and not take it, Rabbi said that he has the right to either pay for the object that is lost or to take an oath that he had nothing. But if he decides to pay and not take the oath, then if the thief is found, he'll pay double damages. If he happened to slaughter or sell the animal that he stole, then he'll pay, the Torah suggests. But lemi mishalem, who will we pay the damages to? If he pays to the owner, then it turns out that the owner of the animal or the utensils has received now double. He's received from the guardian who's paid him for the damage, and he's received now from the thief. So the Mishnah tells us, no, if the guardian pays the owner, then the guardian acquires the rights to any double, quadruple, or quintuple damages that arise from the theft, and therefore, if the thief is found, he was to the guardian, not to the owner. Now, this is a very unusual circumstance, because it turns out that the guardian is going to make money on this deal. Because if he happens to know who the thief is, he can pay off the owner, and then he can go see to it that the thief changes, meaning he'll make 100% on his investment of paying back the owner. This has ethical implications, of course, and we'll have to discuss them as we go into the sugya in the Gemara. In any event, the Mishnah goes on and says, Nishba v'lo ratza l'shalem, but if he decides to take the oath and does not want to pay the owner, then nimtza ganav mishalem tashlumei chefel, tavach u'machar mishalem tashlumei arba'a v'chamisha, lemi mishalem leval apikadon. Then if he swears and he doesn't pay, then when the thief is found, naturally the damages will go directly to the owner of the animal or the utensils and not to the guardian. So in one sentence, this Mishnah is dealing with the fact has the right to swear, to take an oath, or to pay for a lost, and that it's not at the discretion of the owner anymore, it's at the discretion of the guardian. He may decide how the relationship is going to proceed. In other words, here rights to the object that he was watching. He has rights to select the double damage if he wants. And this raises questions. How is it possible that the guardian, who's simply doing a favor for the other individual, is receiving rights over the property that he's guarding? That this question is, and the Gemara is going to deal with that. Let's go to the second Mishnah. The second, ilal le'acher u'meta chidarka, if a person rents a cow from his friend and he loans it, he does a secondary entitlement, he loans it to someone else, and while it's with that someone else, the cow dies. Naturally, it's not killed unnaturally, it dies naturally. Yishava ha-socher shemeta kedarka, v'ha-shoel yishalem la-socher. Then the socher, the renter, will take an oath opposite the owner that the animal died naturally and that he is not responsible, and that the shoel will then pay the borrower, the secondary entitler, he will then pay the owner. Now, we have a question here from Miriam that says, why are we going to pay 4 or 5 times? The guardian losing productivity of the sheep. Well, it's the reason for the 4 or 5 times is not mentioned by the Torah. The Torah simply says that if a thief has the audacity to either slaughter or to sell the animal that he has stolen, then his damages jump from 2-fold to 4 or 5-fold. The Mefarshim on the Torah will give us suggested reasons and logic behind this, but it's not necessarily an issue of productivity, because even a normal theft, the owner is losing productivity as well. All right, in any event, let's go back to our second Mishnah. And the renter, to which Rabbi Yosei responds, Rabbi Yosei, as you know, was a student of Rabbi Akiva from the generation of Usha, and he responds to the Stam Mishnah, and he says, Ketzad hala oseh schura b'farotzo shel chaviro le'be'alim. How can it be that this renter, this on his neighbor's property, by giving it to a secondary guardian and then collecting from him. Rather, the secondary guardian will be cow primary, to the primary guardian. The primary guardian will drop out of the arrangement and not collect on it. So we have a machloket. We have an argument in the second Mishnah between the Tanakama and Rabbi Yosei how this arrangement works. However, please note that this second Mishnah is very similar to the first Mishnah in that it discusses how the guardian acquires or does not acquire rights to make financial arrangements with the property of his friend that has been entrusted to him. And therefore, these two first Mishnayot of the Perek form a unit. They discuss the rights of the guardian opposite the owner. Now, I'd like you to tell me, though, how the second Mishnah different than the arrangement in the first Mishnah. What is the chidush of the second Mishnah over the first Mishnah? Who would like to suggest an answer?
In the first Mishnah we're talking about the Shomer Chinam, and the second Mishnah the Shomer Sachar.
Well, in the second Mishnah, we're not talking about a Shomer Sachar, we're talking about a Socher. And the secondary guardian is a Shoel.
Yes, we're talking about a Socher.
Leaving the thief aside, how many individuals are involved in the relationship? I'm sorry? Jay, what did you want to say?
Go on.
In the first Mishnah, how many individuals are involved in the problem other than the thief himself? How many are there? We have the owner and we have the guardian. We have two individuals. How many individuals? Right, two. That's right. 2 versus 3, Ritzela said. That's correct. In the first Mishnah, we have two individuals involved. We have the owner and the guardian. In the second Mishnah, individual is involved. We have the owner, the primary guardian, who is a socher, and a secondary guardian, who is the shoel. It's rise to complications that it was necessary to explain. And therefore, we need the second Mishnah, not the first Mishnah. Also, the second Mishnah is the great bridge to our second unit, which starts with Mishnah Gimel, as you will see. Let's go on to Mishnah Gimel. Mishnah Gimel says, Amar l'shgaliken mane, ve'eni yodea ezemiken. A person says to two others, here you notice that it's just like in, he says, I stole something from one of you, but I don't remember from which one of you I stole it. Or he says, Aviv, Aviv shelechad mikem, hifkid li mane, ezehu, that one of me with a certain amount of money, and I don't know which one, which father did. Then what does he have to do? The mission says, notain laze mane, vilaze mane, shehoda mipi atzmo. Then he has to pay the amount to both of the other individuals involved. So we have three people involved, and here the individual who comes forward is going to have to make sure he fulfills his obligation all around by paying the damage to everyone involved in the circle. Take a look at Mishnah Dalet. Shnaim shifkidu etzel echad, zemane vezematayim. How many people do we have involved here? How many people are involved in Mishnah Dalet? Yes, that's correct. Three. So we have three. Zeul, and so two people have entrusted money by a certain individual. One is entrusted mane, and one is entrusted twice as much. And when it comes time for it, Zeul Omer Shalima Atayim, one claims the 200 as his own. Then what does he do? He only has. He only has 300 coins here, and he has claims for 400. So noten la zemane ve la zemane, he gives 100 to each. Vashaar yehi munach ad shevo Eliyahu. The rest will have to just wait until Eliyahu comes at the end of time to resolve whose it is. Now Rabbi Yose appears. Now, and in Mishnah Dalet, and saying, Ma hifsid haramai. If that's the case, then the individual who needs 200 when he only has 100 coming to him, all he can do is gain. And therefore, everything, the entire amount that has been entrusted, all 300 be left until Eliyahu comes to determine to whom it belongs. And therefore, we're at the person who is fraudulent, the frauding from what he's trying to accomplish. Now, this Mishnah Dalet, notice, continues the theme of Mishnah Bet and Mishnah Gimel, that there are three people involved in the relationship. Mishnah is raising a doubt about the ethical application of the law presented in the Stam Mishnah, in the Tanakhama. And therefore, we seem to have a unit developing here. Look at Mishnah Hey. V'chein shnei kilim, echad yafeh maneh, echad yafeh elef zuz. Similarly, if you have two utensils, one worth 100 and one worth 1,000, and each one claims the better for his own, then the Mishnah says he'll give the smaller one to one of them, and he'll give the value of the smaller utensil to the second, and the rest will be left until Eliyahu comes. And again, Rabbi Yose interjects, that can't work, because then again, the fraud, so instead everything will be left until Eliyahu decides. And we have a remark from Jake Hellman that he finds very often that a certain Tana appears in the, it is as if they specialized. Well, I don't know if they specialize, but the remark is well taken because the Mishnah generally operates on three rivadim, on three layers. On the layer of the Beit Mikdash, on the layer of Yavne, and on the layer of Galil. And therefore, it's very common to find one layer prominently represented because they're common. commenting, they're learning that perek, and they're commenting on it as they go along. Event, what you can see is that Mishnah 2 and Mishnah 3, Mishnah 2, Mishnah 3, Mishnah 4, and Mishnah 5, all of them three parties. However, Mishnah 2 deals with the rights of the guardian, opposite the 3, 4, and 5 deals really with situations of doubt and how you return entrusted property to now two units of Mishnah. We have the first two Mishnayot as one unit that deals with the rights of the guardian, and we have the next three Mishnayot, Gimel, Dalet, and Hay, that deal with doubts in returning property that's being guarded. Now, if we could go on further, but I don't want to use all, we'll note that six units in this chapter of Mishnah. What I'd like to do is give you a study until we meet next week and then ask questions or be in touch with me with the division. As far as I see it, the first two Mishnayot, as I mentioned, form Unit 1. Mishnah Gimel, Dalet, and Hay form Mishnah 6, Mishnah Vav, forms Mishnah Zion and Mishnah Chet form Unit 4. And I'm not even going to tell you I would entitle these units, what the topics are. I'd like you to look at them, try and uncover why I've divided them, suggest alternative divisions based on other criteria. It seems to me that Mishnah Tet and Yud is Unit Mishnah, Mishnah Yud Bet is Unit 6. I do want to point out one other phenomenon about this chapter of Mishnah before we move on. And that is, if you note, the main topic of that is, does the guardian place his hand on his neighbor's property? Is he guilty for using his neighbor's property illegally? This is the major topic of the guardianship brought down in the Torah. But where does this topic appear in Mishnah? If you look, you'll see, where does it appear? Has anyone, the issue of Shlichut Yad? Take a look at Mishnah Yud Bet, the last Mishnah of the Perek. It says, HaSholeach Yad B'Fikadon, Beit Shammai Omrim Yilkeh B'Chaser U'Viyateah, U'Beit Hillel Omrim Kesha'at Hotzah. The last Mishnah of the Perek deals with Shlichut Yad. Yeah, the question is, Paul, in out of the 12th of our chapter, does the main issue of the psukim arise, shlichut yad? So the principle of shlichut yad, of using your neighbor's property illegally, but that's brought down only in the last mishnah of our perek, which is very odd. You would expect it to in the first mishnah of our perek. First define the principle of shlichut yad to all the detailed cases. Wait so long, exactly. So this phenomenon is quite common in the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. If you want to see another example of this, you can see it in the last chapter of Gittin, that at the very end of Gittin, relating to the prince, well, all the rest of the Masechet, of the tractator, deals with prince, with details having to do with divorce. Now, why does Rebbe do this? I think it's important to understand that the purpose of the Mishnah was to be a book of law. And when you're dealing with Psak Halacha, Rebbe is interested first and foremost in dealing with Piskei Halacha that deal with everyday situations that the vast majority of people run into. Because most people are honest. Most people do not put their hand on their neighbor's property in life. Most people don't do that, but they do run into many gray areas that people. And so Rebbe takes a number of units at the beginning of the parish with common guardian and a possible third party, and only after that, when all that is done, he says, all right, now let's summarize the Shlichut Yad and the Machloket Beit Shammai Beit Hillel that lies in back of everything that we have discussed. And he does the same. Now, if we had time, which we don't really. We're going to move on to the Gemara, but there should be another stage in the middle, which is after we've learned the Mishnah, we should be studying all of the Braitot and the Tosefta that are parallel to the Mishnah and amplify it. We aren't going to do all of it. There are many, many sources, as you see, and all of the pages that you received, there are many dozen. I just need to learn them. But I'd just like to learn another one to give you an example of how the parallel sources of the Tanaim enlarge upon what is taught in the Mishnah. Look at the first Mishnah Omer, that he had nothing to do with the disappearance of the property, or he may pay for the property that has disappeared. Now, if you take a look on the sheets that I sent you, you'll see that toward the bottom, we have the parallel sources. And I'd like just to read one of them. The third one that appears after the Mishnah, and it says, Erol v'nigneva, if a person stole it, ve'amar hala hareini mishalem ve'eini nishba, and he says to the owner, don't worry, I'm going to pay you for the lost cow, I'm not going to take an oath, ve'achar kach nimtza haganav, and only then the ganav, the thief, after the socher, the renter has paid, mishalem tashlum mekefa la socher, he's going to pay double damages. The thief will pay double damages. Now we'll add to the Mishnah that we learned. What does this source that I just read to you about the renter add to the Mishnah that we just with the rights of the guardian? Okay? So in any event, apparently what this source is adding, you know, the Mishnah, the law of the Mishnah that deals with the Shomer Chinam, this source is telling us, it's a braita from the Bavli, Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph, it's telling us the same law applies to a socher. We would think that it doesn't apply to a socher. We think that it's not the same law as a Shomer Chinam. Comes the braita and tells us, yes, it does apply to him. And if you look at the next source I brought from Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph, the Braita says that the same law is true of a Shoel, of a Bar. So, in other words, these Braitot add additional cases to the expand on the din of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is relevant also in other cases. Now, the Amoraim of literature of the Tanaim, the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Braitot, and the Midrash Halacha, they knew all of these very well. And their discussion begins after all of the words of the Tanaim have been concluded and have been analyzed. And the Amora only is going to open his mouth and to add something to the discussion if he has something to add that was not covered by the Tanaim, or some problem has arisen in application of the words of the Tanaim to a new situation, or a new ethical or conceptual difficulty analyzed. But everything begins, firstly, with the words of the Tanaim before the Amora speaks. Now, let's go into the Vilna, which is Lamed Gimel Amud Bet to Lamed Dalet Amud Aleph, or you can use the Sugyot that I sent you through Rabbi Kelman. And it doesn't matter. I'm going to be using the Rivadim because I want to teach you so that when we use it afterwards, we'll be able to look at Vilna and see the Rivadim and see the layers in the sugya. Take a look at the first sugya of the Perek, which you find on the first two pages that I sent you through Rabbi Kelman. Do all of you have it? Do all of you have the page in front of you? Who's using Vilna and who's using the Riva page? So I'll know how to help you. Yes, David says he has the, and Paul is using Vilna. So, and Rosella. Has both. Okay. Let's move on. I hope that has at least one or the other. If you take a look, you're using Vilna, scan through the sugya, and could everyone please tell me which Amoraim appear in this sugya? How are we going to identify them? We're going to through their names. Try and find names of Amoraim in the sugya, and tell me who you find. Has anyone found an Amora? Paul, David, Rosella? Yes, good. We have David is responding that he found Rava and Rabbi Zera. That is correct, but there's one other Amora that appears before Rava and Rabbi Zera. Correct. Rami Bar Chama. Very well done. Rami Bar Chama. Now, Rosella says Rabbi Meir, but Rabbi Meir is a Tana, right? And he comes as an earlier source by the Amoraim. Now, what does it matter which Amoraim appear in the Siddur topic? We're interested in the content, in the concepts, in the abstractions, in the leaks. The answer to this, of course, is, as I mentioned to you during our sessions in Toronto, that the Amoraim appear in chronological sequence. That is, this is an Amoraic sugya because Rami Bar Chama is like, and Rava is the teacher of Rabbi Zera, who's Rabbi Zera the third from the fifth generation. And therefore, we have here a late third generation and a fifth generation Amora. Orderly appearance of the three Amoraim is not by chance. It's by design. It's by, because the three statements that were present here on this Mishnah before any of the rest of the Gemara Sugya was written. The rest of the Gemara Sugya is as lesson of these three Amoraim. And therefore, what we need to do is to divide the material in the Sugya into its component parts, the Amoraim in the Sugya, and then read the Stamma de Gemara, and understand the Stamma de Gemara as a commentary on the words of the Amoraim. We can then ask ourselves questions such as, what is the Mishnah? And what is each succeeding Amora adding to the Amora who preceded him? And what adding to the image? And when we look at the Gemara this way, we're able to discern that there was a proof of thinking that Rami Bar Chama is attacking the Aramaic piece before him, which he is not. And therefore, Rashi comes and tells us, that's right, Jay says he can't attack the Stama as he lived before them, for the authors of the Stama de Gemara, and therefore he could not be attacking them. And what we have here in the Sugya is a bit of an optic illusion. It gives us the impression that the Stama de Gemara is speaking first, and only after that is Rami Bar Chama answering. But this is not so. Rami Bar Chama was there first. The Stama de Gemara inserted a piece before him in order to clarify a certain issue in the Mishnah that they wanted to clarify. And then they returned to the existing Amoraic Sugya. And this is a klal gadol in the study of Gemara according to the sequence. One learns it according to the layers. First, you learn the Mishnah and the Braita, then you learn the Amoraim, and then you learn the Stama de Gemara after that. Rami Bar Chama is saying, Ha in adar shelo ba la'olam. He's saying, how is it possible that a person can acquire rights to something that does not exist yet? It is a given halachic principle, says Rami Bar Chama, that one can never acquire rights. One can never sell or buy something that does not yet exist. Now, what is happening in the Mishnah? Who is gaining rights over something that does not yet exist? As I'm sure you all said, the guardian. The guardian is obtaining rights, but to double, no thief even exists yet. The animal hasn't been stolen. No thief has been found. No thief has been obligated. So it's a davar shalo ba la'olam. It's something that doesn't exist. If the rights of the guardian include acquisition, quadruple or quintuple from the thief, should he steal, should he be found, and should he be obligated to pay? In essence, he's acquiring rights to something that does not yet exist. It's impossible, halakhically. So what is Rami Bar Chama adding to the Tanaitic material? That's correct, that he paid for it, but that doesn't matter. What we're seeing here is that the guardian has the right to select whether he's going to take an oath or whether he is going to pay. That means that the rights are already inherent theft. If the rights are inherent in the guardian before the theft, then the owner has given to the guardian something that does not yet exist. Here comes Rami Bar Chama's question. Now, Rami Bar Chama's question would be just equally as powerful that if, a bit later in the Gemara, and he's, as David says, he's posing an ethical question, but not only an ethical, a halachic question. He's saying the category of transactions is you may not sell or purchase something that does not yet exist. How, therefore, does this guardian acquire rights to something that does not yet exist? Now, Rava, who comes after Rami Bar Chama, answers this question, is then attacked by Rabbi Zeira, and then Rabbi Zeira provides the final solution to the sugya. Rabbi Kelman, do we have more time?
2 minute warning, I think. Two minute warning, with one timeout.
2 minute warning. Okay. So Rava. Rava comes up with it to Rami Bar Chama. He's not a problem, acquiring to exist, because what the owner is saying to the guardian is, if my animal should be stolen, well, it's under your care, and if the thief should be found, and you should desire to pay me rather than take an oath, then you can consider it as if my cow, which I entrusted to you, is owned by you from now, from the point of the beginning of the guardianship. Retroactivity on the ownership that takes effect only after the theft. Once there is a thief, and if there is a thief, there are at least, in principle, rights to double, quadruple, or quintuple damage. So Rava is solving the problem by saying there is no transfer of rights until after the theft. But you would say, why do I need the retroactivity? Because he says after the theft, he cannot acquire the rights on the animal because the animal isn't with him anymore. So Rava says the right will be acquired after the theft, but they will be acquired at that point in time retroactively to the moment when the guardianship started. And therefore, the animal will still be there, happening after the thief is already in existence, and the double damages are not something that has not yet come into the world. Shalom Ba'olam. This retroactive solution of Rava, in our next session, will be challenged by Rabbi Zeira. And what I'd like you to do for homework, if I may, go through the material of the Tanaim that I sent you, and try and map the relationship between the Mishnah Yot and the Braitot that appear next to them on the pages. Second of all, go through this sugya that we started to learn and try and understand what Rabbi Zeira is contributing to the Amoraic discussion in the fifth generation. After you've done that, try to go back and learn the Stamid de Gemara on top of the Amoraim and see if you can understand what are the functions of the Stamid de Gemara in this sugya. And we will discuss this next time. At this next week, same time, same station on the broadcasting network. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Like Rabbi Hayman mentioned, I think he's happy to take any of your emails or questions. Now, if anybody has any questions they want to speak up by hitting the transmit button, or if you want to send them emails, or they'll be happy to answer. So if anybody has any questions, you can speak up.
Are there other questions or any other comments?
Yes, there will be an MP3.
My email address is Hayman, P, HAYMANP, at smile.net.il. Again, Hayman, P, HAYMANP, at smile.net.il. Are there any other questions? Either about the method or about the content.
In addition to those who misrasted in the class and don't really know anything about the theme like method yet, or are just learning, Rabbi Hayman recommends that you go to the Rabbi Hayman website and do some of the reading, like background. Am I correct, Rabbi?
Yes, that would be a good thing to do. Or if you have any specific questions that way, and you should all have a pleasant day, and we'll look forward to seeing you again next week.